My name is Mark Rienzi, and I'm a law professor at Catholic University, where I teach, among other things, constitutional law. I'm delighted to be here with this really talented and experienced panel to talk about the issue of conscientious objections in the healthcare context, in the medical field. What I'd like to do is just give you sort of a really quick 2-minute introduction to the issue. It's an issue that in some ways probably needs no introduction. And then introduce you to our panelists, each of whom is going to come up and give probably 8 to 10 minutes worth of comments on the issue. And then I think the panel will engage in some back and forth discussion. And then what I hope we'll do is get plenty of questions from you all. So I encourage everybody to take out a pen and paper and write down your questions as you go. And hopefully we'll have time for plenty of them. The conscience issue is one of those really fascinating issues that come up in a pluralistic democracy, which is, what do you do when you have people who have different views of what is right and wrong, different views of what they wish to do? You have medical procedures that are controversial to some people and not to others. And you have claims by providers that I'm willing to participate in procedures A, B, and C, but perhaps not D, E, and F. In the Supreme Court's decision in Roe v. Wade, the decision basically assumes and talks about the presence of a willing physician to provide the abortion, a physician who wants to do it. But the decision also acknowledges that, obviously, not all physicians share the same views about abortion. And in the companion case of Doe v. Bolton, the court notes that Georgia has what it called appropriate protections, pieces of its statute that allowed individual providers and hospitals not to participate in providing abortions. Justice Blackmun in Doe mentions that in passing, doesn't quite say this is required, doesn't say this is a problem, just mentions it in passing. After Roe, we see an explosion at the state and federal level of these conscience clauses. The states, you get them in almost every state. You have state laws that at one level or another, and for some number of procedures, and they vary across the states, say there are certain things that you can't force a healthcare professional to do. And at the federal level, you see a range of different laws. The first ones were called the Church Amendments, which are often written into funding statutes that say any recipient of these funds cannot force someone to participate in an abortion or a sterilization, things like that. What happens in 2008 is the Bush administration issues a bunch of regulations issued by the Bush administration HHS. And those regulations essentially say, look, we have these federal statutes on the books, but there's no clear indication of how they should be enforced or what should be done about them. Let's have some regulations to tell people how to do that. When President Obama is elected, he moves to rescind those regulations, and in fact, they were rescinded earlier this year. What's left is a controversy that has raged on, in some sense, from right around the time of Roe to the present, of this potential conflict between the autonomy rights of the patients who want to receive what is a legal medical procedure, whether it's abortion or in some states assisted suicide or in some places emergency contraception, and providers who claim the right not to provide it. The panel we have here to discuss that is, as I said, a truly excellent panel for this issue. First, immediately to my left, we have Dr. Greg Bloch. Who is, among other things, a professor of law here at the Georgetown University Law Center. He's also co-director of Georgetown's joint program with Johns Hopkins in law and public health. His work on health policy issues has been featured in many prestigious law reviews and also in prestigious medical journals, including the New England Journal of Medicine. He was a healthcare advisor to President Obama's 2008 presidential campaign and transition, and he speaks frequently on issues of healthcare and healthcare policy.
And can I get you to plug the book?
And he's got a book called The Hippocratic Myth, Why Doctors Are Under Pressure to Ration Care, Practice Politics, and Compromise Their Promise to Heal. And it's right here. And I bet he'll sign it for you if you buy it. To Dr. Block's left is Dr. Farr Curlin, the second doctor on our panel. Dr. Curlin is an associate professor of medicine at the University of Chicago. And he's also co-director of the University of Chicago's program on medicine and religion. He graduated from the University of North Carolina School of Medicine, completed his residency at the University of Chicago, and his research focuses on physicians moral traditions and commitments, and medical ethics questions. And his work also has been featured in the New England Journal of Medicine, among other places. To Dr. Kerlin's left, we have Professor Jesse Hill. Professor Hill is a professor at Case Western Reserve University School of Law. Her teaching focuses on constitutional law, civil rights, reproductive rights, and law and religion. She's a graduate of Brown University and Harvard Law School. Her scholarship has been featured in many prestigious journals, including the Michigan Law Review, the Duke Law Journal, and the Texas Law Review. Prior to teaching, she worked at the Reproductive Freedom Project for the ACLU in New York, and in private practice, she litigated cases concerning the First Amendment and civil rights law. Professor Hill also clerked for Judge Karen Nelson Moore on the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Furthest down on the panel is Professor Robert Destro, a colleague of mine at Catholic University. Professor Destro is a professor of law at Catholic, and he's the founding director of Catholic's interdisciplinary program on law and religion. He's been at the law school since 1982. From 1983 to 1989, Professor Destro served as a commissioner on the United States Commission on Civil Rights, and led the commission's discussions in the areas of discrimination on the basis of disability, national origin, and religion. He received his Bachelor of Arts degree from Miami University in Ohio, and his law degree from the University of California at Berkeley. And among many other publications, he's the author of a textbook on religious liberty in a pluralistic society. So with that introduction, I'd like to invite Dr. Block to take the mic and give us some remarks on the issue of conscience in medicine. Dr. Block.
Thank you very much. I want to thank the Federal Society for inviting me. I suppose I'm here as kind of the left of center reasonable person. I guess that's what my role is supposed to be. But I'm reminded of my quite conservative colleague, who is, I think, a Federal Society member, David Hyman's warning to me about the middle of the road, that there are only two yellow lines and lots of dead animals there. And so maybe, especially in Washington, especially now, that's a dangerous place to be. I want to start by locating today's discussion within a larger context, the moral content of medical judgment. And actually, it's that more than so-called conscientious objection specifically that I'm going to talk about, but I think it does set the larger context. In my book, The Hippocratic Myth, and yes, I'd be delighted to sign any copies that you acquire in the course of this event, I argue that doctors practice morality and politics unavoidably in the course of practicing medicine. The Hippocratic Oath doesn't acknowledge this. It promises devotion to the good of patients without speaking to how doctors understand this good. The oath's silence on this question is vexing. The silence stokes the controversy over the role of doctors' personal moral views that we're here today to engage. I'd like to start with a story, the story of Jeans Cruz. I interviewed him in depth for The Hippocratic Myth, and I tell his story in some more detail in the book. Jeans Cruz grew up in what he called a war zone, the South Bronx. After 9/11, he volunteered for another, enlisting in the U.S. Army as a cavalry scout. Despite disciplinary problems, "I have a short fuse," he told me. He was picked for an elite recon team. He rode to Baghdad and then to Crete in the Iraq War's early weeks. Cruz manned the 50 caliber gunner slot atop a Humvee, spotting snipers and getting lucky when bullets ricocheted his way. Men died when he saw their muzzle flashes and returned their fire with precision. The Bronx street brawler had become a warrior, winning medals for valor and his fellow soldiers' awe. Cruz was later assigned to a special forces squad charged with seizing suspected insurgents and finding fellow soldiers taken hostage. As a hunter of men, Cruz excelled. "I loved working with special forces," he told me. "They were smarter. They trusted you when you showed that you could do something." What he could do was to move by stealth, stay hidden in grass and trees, and quietly dispense with any locals unfortunate enough to spot him lying in wait. Dressed as a farmer, he'd sometimes walk into unfriendly villages, knowing that discovery by a kid or a barking dog could mean a quick, violent death. More than once, he spent nights on roofs, frozen in place to keep from making a sound, listening to the conversations below. And for a week in December of 2003, he was assigned to watch comings and goings at a farm on the Tigris River near the village of Adwar. He hid in palm groves and lemon orchards amid swarming insurgents in Iraq's Sunni heartland. Then on December 14th, the command came to go in. A raiding party of several hundred assembled at dusk. Special forces teams, scouts, and regular infantry, ignorant about the mission's objectives. Different groups took different areas, Cruz recalled. You get instructions to cover an area. We know where the house is, where the farm is, where the water flows through. We can look at the pictures and know where they are on the map. We started the raid at midnight, he remembers. We went in hard. They were firing, flash, bang. Beneath the house, the raiders found tunnels and bunkers with weapons and money. The original plan had been for Cruz to ride in on a truck as part of the strike on the main house. But plans changed. Cruz and two of his recon buddies were given an area outside the house and ordered to go in on foot, over ground thought to be booby-trapped with explosives. Wearing night vision gear, the three moved in, spotting landmarks they'd seen in photos and looking for wires sticking up from the ground. They came across three depressions in the earth, obviously dug by human hands. Each appeared to be bomb-free. Then they noticed a small stream, not on their map, with a few PVC pipes poking up beside it. Near the pipes was a tiny foot rug covered in mud. One of the three, Cruz doesn't recall who, lifted the rug. Beneath it was what looked like a large cinder block, about a foot square, with ropes attached. The three pulled hard on the ropes, and the block came up easily. It was styrofoam. Below was blackness. They'd come across an entrance to an underground space. For a second, there was silence and sheer terror. Then Cruz took a deadly risk. He tossed in a flash grenade, a device designed to explode in non-lethal fashion, leaving enemy personnel temporarily blind, deaf, and disoriented. If the flash grenade had blown up other explosives, we'd have been blown up, he told me. Explosives had been found in nearby bunkers, but a second, then two or three went by after the grenade ignited without a follow-on blast or any other sound. He decided to go down through the opening, and to fit through, he took off his equipment, his pack, his first aid kit, and other strapped-on gear. He then leapt in, stumbling, then regaining his footing at the bottom of a chamber not much bigger than a powder room. A dazed and stinking man stood his ground by a bunk bed, holding an AK-47 and a pistol. My heart was pumping, Cruz told me. The guy could have fired off some rounds. I rushed him, tackled him, and got the weapons from him. All he said to us was he was the president of Iraq and he was Saddam Hussein. We got him out, transported him to the house, and waited for the chopper to come to take him, Cruz remembers. I walked back to the Humvee. My God, I thought, just let it be him so we could go home. It was Saddam, as America's viceroy in Baghdad, Paul Bremer, told the world the next day. The same day, Cruz's commanders told his recon unit that their tour was being extended for several months. 2 weeks after taking Saddam, though, Cruz returned from a combat operation, soaked in blood from a wounded comrade. Within hours, he was on his way to Baghdad, then to Baltimore, Washington Airport for some time with his family. I was still wearing the bloody uniform on the flight from Baltimore to LaGuardia, he remembers. Cruz came home to his wife, infant son, and the American way of celebrity. Appearances on ABC's The View, CNN with Paul Azan, and other programs followed. He was suddenly one of the country's most celebrated soldiers, an icon of post 9/11 patriotism and derring do. Then it was back to Iraq's Sunni heartland and combat's random terror, and his resilience began to falter. You start having hallucinations. Our commanders would say it's from the heat. His body took a battering as well. There was back pain and bloody urine that never went away. A year went by before doctors found that he fractured bones in his foot and that they'd grown together the wrong way. Memories pursued him relentlessly through the night. Ambushes, guys running, guys just dropping. There are uglier moments, still more relentless. There were certain missions where we had to keep everything quiet, he remembers. But sometimes, he said, they'd encounter children while hiding in trees, on roofs, or elsewhere. The kids, he said, would set off a ruckus, revealing the Americans' positions. Some special forces commanders claimed the kids didn't do so innocently. Insurgents, he said, sent kids out to look for U.S. troops and to make noise so that their fighters could flee or attack when the Americans appeared. The preventive measures practiced by special forces, soldiers on stealth missions, Cruz said, was to silence anybody who might out them by killing quietly if need be. In March of 2004, Cruz's tour of duty in Iraq came to an end. With most of the 4th Infantry, he was airlifted to Fort Hood, Texas, the division's home. His life deteriorated from there. The nightmares and panic attacks grew worse. His relationship with his wife fell apart. There were altercations with officers, fellow soldiers, and medical personnel. Crowds set me off, he told me. I feared someone would start shooting and there'd be nowhere to run. Cruz's symptoms qualified him for the diagnosis of PTSD, or post-traumatic stress disorder, as defined by the source that American medicine treats as authoritative, the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, known as the DSM. Health insurers and public agencies that provide medical care, including the Pentagon and the VA, have adopted the DSM's diagnostic categories and criteria. As a psychiatrist in training, too many years ago for me to want to count, I was taught that these categories and criteria were the product of science, epidemiological studies showing that these disorders existed. The criteria for PTSD, I learned, followed from state-of-the-art understanding of war trauma and its psychic effects. Neither politics nor moral judgment played a role, we were taught. PTSD and its criteria represented psychiatry's best effort to describe a symptom that was found in nature. But as Jeans Cruz underwent evaluation for his intrusive memories and explosive behavior, a political challenge to the diagnosis of PTSD was in full swing. Conservative critics of the diagnosis claimed it miscasts personal challenge as pathological process. The horrors of war, they said, call for courage and resilience, not the makeover of warriors as victims. Men and women who return home from combat must reconcile their battlefield experiences with their lives before and after. This challenge, the conservative critic said, called for character, not the dependence that accompanies the sick role. The culture of therapy, conservatives argued, rewards passivity, not personal responsibility. It coddles dysfunction and punishes self-reliance by withholding free health care and disability benefits from those who don't prevail upon their doctors to diagnose PTSD. More insidiously, PTSD's conservative critics complained, it gives short shrift to armed conflict as an honorable endeavor by encouraging citizens to stigmatize its veterans as sufferers, not heroes. The Bush administration pressed this critique of PTSD, and within the Pentagon and the VA, it gained momentum. The politics of the Iraq War played a role. Fewer diagnoses of PTSD meant the war would cost less over the long term. The authors of the DSM rejected the conservative critique, but some doctors didn't. Jeans Cruz was not given the diagnosis of PTSD. He was told he had a personality disorder, and he was discharged from the Army on a less than honorable basis against his will. And he was denied, at least for a while, post-discharge medical and disability benefits. Conservatives who said PTSD wasn't an illness or who tried to shrink its scope had a point. The diagnosis rested on moral premises about personal responsibility, heroism, resilience, and dependency. So do many other diagnostic and therapeutic judgments. In the Hippocratic myth, I point to a host of other clinical practices and policies with moral underpinnings that medicine doesn't like to talk about. The Hippocratic ideal of devotion to the well-being of patients makes it harder to discuss these moral underpinnings. Medicine and society would benefit from more upfront discussion and resolution of the moral questions that undergird clinical practice. The kerfuffle over conscientious objection in medicine has the potential to make a positive contribution by bringing resolution of these questions out into the open. But the Hippocratic Oath does stand clearly for the proposition that doctors are not isolated moral actors. It's the patient's good that's supposed to be their moral anchor. The profession and healthcare payers, and sometimes, more often today, courts and legislators, work out the parameters within which the patient's good is determined. In similar messy ways, we work through our differences about the purposes of medicine, the scope of the therapeutic, and the place of medicine's many non-therapeutic purposes, including medicine's role in criminal justice, national security, performance enhancement, and other public realms. The process is often messy. It's laden with politics. Cultural conservatives and cultural liberals should have a voice in it. But individual doctors have quite narrow scope for indulging their own moral preferences when these preferences lie outside the parameters of the parameters that the profession and society say constitute appropriate medical practice. Health insurance contracts through the marketplace, medical tort law, and medical licensing and disciplinary bodies enforce these parameters. A doctor who, on her own, decides that Jean's Cruz shouldn't be given the diagnosis of PTSD because this diagnosis denies his personal responsibility and intrudes upon the martial virtues acts outside these parameters. A doctor who refuses to provide statin drugs to fat, sedentary patients with high LDLs, or low-density lipoproteins, because he thinks they ought to take charge of their lives by quitting Taco Bell and doing more cardio at the gym, acts outside these parameters. Being a doctor has always meant living within them. Since the 1970s, it's also come to mean deferring to patients' autonomy within the range set by these parameters. There's plenty of room here for doctors to try to make medical practice better by trying to change these parameters on both scientific and moral grounds. But there's minimal room for being a moral lone ranger. For being conscientious as a doctor means keeping one's private moral preferences in check. My worry about the conscientious objection kerfuffle is that it unties medical practice from this sort of conscientiousness. And to be frank, it seems to do so quite selectively. On matters involving women's erotic experience, sex for purposes of intimate connection and pleasure, disconnected from reproduction, and other related matters like the end of life that have been, I think, distorted in their form, in the way we understand them, by the ferocity of the abortion discussion. Much more that I could say, but I'm going to stop, and I'll wait till our discussion.
And now we'll hear from Dr. Kerlin. Thank you, Dr. Block.
I don't think when people think about the conscientious refusals and the right of conscience policies, they typically think of the case of PTSD or the disputes about that, but perhaps they should. I certainly would agree with Dr. Block that physicians, when they practice medicine, practice politics and practice morality, and that's inescapable. The question is whether when there's a reasoned disagreement in a population about the right politics and about whether a certain practice is moral, what should be done. And we might, to put a little finer point on it, ask the question, let's say that you're in a and this is to push back on the notion that doctors have always known that they were supposed to practice according to the whatever political arrangements are worked out. If you're in a state where physicians are asked to supervise interrogation, the question would be, do you think that's clearly worked out that they should? I mean, the state has told them they should. It's been established under the law that they should. Or should doctors in that case be able to recuse themselves? Or if you're in a state that asks people to participate in lethal injection for convicted criminals, there are ways you can imagine a state would ask doctors to act, and doctors do, in fact, many of them refuse to so act. So President Obama in 2009, when he made clear that he intended most likely to rescind Bush's regulations regarding conscientious refusals, said something I think very important. He said, I think this regulation has disrupted a prior balance that was, this is a paraphrase, but that balance was the right balance regarding this issue. And I think he is right in the sense that this is really a question of balance. There are a couple issues that most people think are important. They think it's important for people to have the freedom to seek to obtain those goods and services that have been politically established as legal and that within the profession of medicine have been established as permissible by the profession. They think they should have some, they should not be constrained unduly in their efforts to seek to obtain those procedures. They also, most people also think that professionals should not be asked and shouldn't have the law there to constrain them to do things that they believe are wrong, that to act against their own best understanding of how they ought to act. And the question is, well, how do you balance these two goods? And it seems to me that Obama's policy rescinding the Bush policies does in fact go back to the prior balance, at least as that balance is expressed in federal regulations. He essentially just goes, the only thing that has changed now is there's a clear office that people can apply to for enforcement of prior federal statutes. So the question, I think that's an interesting one, is why would people within the profession, some people, have the sense that the balance is being pushed in the other direction, that the balance is being pushed toward physicians being constrained or other healthcare workers being asked to act against their own consciences. And in fact, in the comments, Obama's administration's comments, when they released their rescission of these policies, they wrote, many commenters on the, when they opened up their decision to comment before they made it. They said many commenters speculated that eliminating provider conscience protections would cause healthcare providers to leave the profession, which would reduce access to healthcare services. Additionally, thousands of commenters suggested that rescinding the 2008 final rule would violate the First Amendment religious freedom rights of providers or the tenets of the Hippocratic Oath, and would impact the ethical integrity of the medical profession. While the department carefully considered these comments, we do not specifically address them because this partial rescission does not alter or affect the existing federal statutory health care provider conscience protections. So I'm not an attorney or a constitutional law scholar, and so I'm just going to propose to you why there are good reasons, there are public goods that are at stake and are threatened when policies seek to reduce the space in which people can conscientiously refuse. That policies that seek to force, with the power of the law, people to do things or participate in things that they believe are immoral. And that's to leave undecided what the right way is to secure those goods. I really am agnostic about the proper way or the proper role of federal regulations in that. But here's why I think we should shore up in all venues the freedom of conscientious refusal for clinicians. The first is that conscientious refusals are central to the practice of medicine. It is often suggested that these are some kind of marginal activity to basically aimed at women and their sexuality, and there's nothing that could be farther from the truth. You cannot conceive of a good physician who does not regularly, conscientiously refuse things that the patient asks of him or her. Patients ask for antibiotics. There are cases when antibiotics meet some criteria that are published in the literature. The physician decides antibiotics, in his or her best judgment, don't fit in this case. They refuse. Patients ask for imaging studies. They meet certain criteria in the literature, but all things considered, there's ambiguity about that. The physician thinks this is not going to be helpful in your case. They refuse. There are surgeons are asked to do surgery. One of their partners would do it. This surgeon says, in my judgment, that's a dangerous surgery. It's not going to achieve its goals. I will not do it. Every physician who is a decent physician is regularly, conscientiously refusing things that patients ask. So the question is not whether conscientious refusals are a problem. The question is whether there's some criteria we can use to distinguish those refusals that are justified from those that are not. And that, I think, highlights the fact that there has been a central politics that's been at the heart of the medical profession from the times of Hippocrates and probably before to now. And that is there's a shared sense across all the liberal and conservative and religious and secular groups that doctors, if nothing else, are committed to preserving and restoring patients' health when it's threatened. Now, when you define health in a relatively objective way, you find that doctors agree entirely about that goal. But there are cases in which it's not clear how best to preserve that health. And then there are cases in which there are ways of using medical resources that are not so obviously connected to health, objectively defined. Contraception is the most classic example and historically the most powerful one for changing the way we think about medicine. But the point is, you can define medicine as committed to health, and where on the margins it's not clear how best to preserve that health, and where on the margins it's not clear that people are pursuing something that's actually related to health, you can allow them to opt out if they need to do so conscientiously. And you can still maintain a profession that way. Here's why I think that's what we should do, rather than starting to say that the physician in the case of PTSD should somehow be censured because the physician, let's presume, is acting in good faith. It's one thing to set them up as a caricature, but most physicians acting in good faith, I think we know that among physicians who act in good faith in the world of psychiatry, there's real disagreement about whether PTSD is a diagnosis that properly applies to all the different cases, which some would apply to PTSD too. It's a difficult diagnosis to make. There's an area of enormous ambiguity. So if a physician comes to the conclusion, I don't think this is PTSD, should they have the freedom to not make that diagnosis? Or should they be said, well, under the law, you will make the diagnosis? That's the kind of question we're dealing with. Second reason to support conscientious refusals is that the refusals are expressions of disagreement about whether a practice is required by our commitment to health or whether it's something else. And it allowing conscientious refusals allows within the profession a form of kind of self-correcting dispute. In other words, when you have a community and there's disagreement in different practices within it, then the whole community has to consider why they practice as they do. But if the state comes in and says everyone's going to practice in this way, then no longer can you even imagine the possibility of practicing otherwise. Third, we've had for a lot of different reasons a push within medicine toward medicine not so much aimed at health as medicine as the provision of healthcare services. And when we think of medicine as the provision of healthcare services, it does reduce physicians' agency. Physicians are no longer considered, their judgment is no longer, frankly, pertinent to their practice of medicine. They just provide healthcare services in some kind of competent way, and patients decide whether they want them. That does cause people to leave the profession. There's enormous amount of evidence that particularly primary care physicians are leaving the practice of medicine in a steady stream. Part of it is because of a lot of forces that say, we don't care what you think. You know, get your personal values out of medicine and just do whatever the state says or some kind of third party says. When we constrain conscientious refusal, it makes it hard for people to practice conscientiously. Right now, everyone who believes on a deep level that it is good to preserve and restore patients' health and is willing to discipline themselves to the practices to bring that about is welcome in the practice of medicine in the United States. But if we're going to say that you must provide contraception, then you can see how some Roman Catholics or other people who think that contraception is not really a valid practice of medicine, I mean, making a person sterile who's of reproductive age is it's not as consistent with health as taking out their inflamed appendix, that those people can't practice medicine any longer, or can't practice OBGYN. And this process continues. Every time you reduce the range of refusals that's permitted, you reduce the number of people who can practice medicine conscientiously. And so I'm going to wrap up there for now, but I think that there are reasons, there are good reasons to think that we should, in whatever policies are passed, keep the state from getting involved in constraining people's conscientious practices in a way that would basically make it impossible for certain physicians to practice medicine conscientiously, and then would reduce the practice of medicine to the provision of healthcare services according to the politics of the patient. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Carlin. Now we'll hear from Professor Hill.
Well, since Dr. Block suggested that he was invited to be on this panel as the left-of-center reasonable person, I can only infer that I was invited to be the left-of-center unreasonable voice on this panel. I hope I'll disappoint. I hope I'll disappoint with respect to that expectation. But, you know, my view, I'll just, and I'm going to be focusing, I think, more on the legal side of things than on the sort of clinical and ethical side of things. But my view in terms of how these things should be handled is that I'm not opposed to the availability of conscientious refusal for healthcare professionals. I think that's absolutely fine so long as no harm results to patients and that they continue to have access to services and information about those services. So in light of this overall view, my sense of how this would apply in the particular case in front of us is that the Bush reg that was largely repealed by the Obama regulation was too broad in ways that I'll talk about in a moment, and that the Obama regulation is mostly the appropriate way to go, which is also to say that I don't object to most of the underlying statutes that continue to be in place with respect to conscientious objection, with one exception that I'll talk about. I just want to first then start out by making one point, which is that, and this has already been mentioned by some of our other speakers, that there have been these statutes protecting healthcare professionals' right to refuse certain procedures, particularly abortion, and providing that they can't be discriminated against because of their refusal. These sorts of statutes have been in place since, since 1973. That's almost 40 years. And we never had a regulation about it until 2008. So my first point would just be to say that I'm not sure we really needed a regulation to ensure that these rights were protected. And I'm hoping that that's an argument that even the Federalist Society can love, right? We didn't need federal regulation, additional red tape and regulation in this area. With the exception of the fact that there's now this enforcement mechanism through the Office of Civil Rights of the HHS, and you know, I think that that's reasonable that maybe an enforcement mechanism needed to be created, and that was retained by the Obama regulation. Okay, the second point that I'd like to make is that I think that it's fairly uncontroversial to say that there is no free exercise, First Amendment, free exercise of religion, constitutional right to an exemption from a generally applicable law that would require, for example, provision of certain services like contraception. There's no First Amendment right. Now, might there be another constitutional basis for this right? Actually, our moderator, Professor Ranzi, has actually argued that there might be for, or that there is, actually, for providers who want to refuse to provide abortions, for example. Okay, I can actually accept that. But there is no free exercise right to an exemption from a law that might require provision of, for example, something like contraceptives. And so, or any generally applicable law. And so I think we have to acknowledge that healthcare provider conscience provisions give special treatment to healthcare providers in this area or to healthcare providers in general. Now, is that a bad thing? Is that a good thing? Are there good reasons for that? Possibly, right? But I just want to be clear that healthcare providers get special treatment, that other people don't get protection for their religious beliefs in this manner or are not entitled to it necessarily. Okay. Third, I want to make a couple of quick points about the existing regulations, the Obama regulation, which repealed the Bush regulation. I think that the Bush regulation was too broad and needed to be repealed in one very important respect that I'll talk about here, which is in its definition of what it meant to assist in an abortion procedure. This is one of the things that the Bush regulation did, was define the term assist in an abortion procedure. It didn't, however, define the term abortion, which is interesting because initially there was an early draft which suggested it might define abortion itself very broadly and such that it could be read to include contraception. But that was never enacted, that broad definition. But the definition of to assist in an abortion includes counseling, referring for an abortion, and making other arrangements for an abortion. And my sense is that this is going a little bit over the line. I don't think it's a good idea, and it may well be unconstitutional to force anyone to participate directly in or perform an abortion. However, I do think it is it has the potential to interfere with patients' right to information, doctors' obligation to obtain informed consent, and patients' right to make autonomous decisions about their health care with all the information available to them, when this includes the right to refuse to give patients information about all their reproductive health options. Under federal law, which is arguably the effect of that definition. And there are a couple of reasons why I think this is problematic. One is that I think that it's somewhat incoherent, actually, to say that it violates someone's conscience if someone else is doing something. So I don't see how it violates a physician's conscience if someone else is enabled to make a choice to have an abortion. But even if we put aside that view, I think at a minimum, I think it's reasonable to say that the professional norms that physicians subscribe to and other healthcare professionals subscribe to, I don't think that those norms require them to perform procedures like abortion that they object to. I do think that they at least have to subscribe to, again, the values of patient autonomy and informed consent to the extent that, at least within the parameters of appropriate medical care, that at least that patients are given information about those options and able to exercise autonomous choice. Again, and as our first two speakers have pointed out, what is the range of appropriate health care? What constitutes health? That is a very disputed definition. I agree, and I think it might be something we'd want to talk about more in the more freewheeling part of this discussion. But I do think my view is that these options like abortion, emergency contraception for rape victims, and so on, are things that are considered within the standard of care, within the range of appropriate medical treatment, and not that physicians should have to perform them if they object, but that they should be able to, or that they should have to enable patients to choose those procedures. I also think, the definition of assist is so broad that it could interfere with the way that various entities run their business. I mean, it's so broad that it could, for example, prevent a company from firing, a security guard that won't protect Planned Parenthood, in a government-owned or in a building, for example. It reaches as far as every sort of employee, even the entire workforce. And the definition of assist is so broad that it could include even acts like carrying out, like I said, an obligation to be a security guard for an abortion clinic as well as other healthcare clinics in a building, for example. Finally, I just want to mention that the other pre-existing provision that I think is too broad is the provision that prevents any entity receiving federal money from requiring anyone to perform or assist in any healthcare service if it's contrary to their conscience. And a lot of folks have pointed out, and I'll just mention quickly because I don't want to go on too long, but that that this provision potentially allows healthcare providers to discriminate on all kinds of bases against individuals and not just to decline to perform procedures or provide particular kinds of services when they object to the service. If you are permitting providers not to provide any service that they object to, arguably that allows providers to refuse to provide service to gays and lesbians, HIV-positive individuals, anyone where they might find that their conscience is threatened by providing a service to that individual. I think I'm going to wrap up there. I think that kind of covers the basics of my view about the overbreadth of the Bush regulation, and I'll turn it over to my final speaker.
Thanks very much, Professor Hill, and now we'll hear from Professor Destro.
Okay. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here today. I'm going to take an additional step back And in addition to teaching constitutional law and dealing with law and religion issues, I also teach professional responsibility. And so I want to kind of step back and talk a little bit about the ethics of these issues, and also to talk a little bit about the environment in which we find ourselves today, which is a law school. And so I'm going to start by pointing out an absolutely fascinating article that originally appeared in 1987 in the Journal of Law and Religion called The Ordinary Religion of the Law School Classroom. And it was written by former Cornell Dean Roger Crampton. And he talked about a series of assumptions about the place of morals. I mean, basically the kind of the implicit assumptions that guide how law school curricula are put together. And he basically says, look, this implicit value structure is so pervasive and so well accepted that it's a bit like air. People don't even begin to question it because it's just such a part of life. And he sparked a huge outcry when he wrote that. There were several beyond the ordinary religion articles, and it's a discussion we don't have very often. And it's one that that I think forms the backdrop of the discussions we have here. Because in many respects, I mean, I can think of a law school dean of a law school whose name you would recognize, not this one, but you would certainly recognize the law school, who got up at an Association of American Law Schools convention and said, I quote, "I would never hire a pro-lifer because nobody on our faculty would want to talk to him or her," unquote. Now, the fact that anybody could get up and say that, and not get hooted out of the room tells you a lot about the ordinary religion when it comes to these kinds of issues. Okay, and it also tells you an awful lot about the culture of American law schools. I'll give you another example, which is far more pedestrian, but just as telling. A very good friend who does law and religion at a major Midwestern law school called me a number of years ago when he proposed a law and religion seminar, to which his faculty objected on First Amendment grounds. He said, this is a state law school. You shouldn't be talking about religion here. Okay, and it's one of those strange things that you can't make up, but is nevertheless true. And so, I start from the kind of the opposite perspective of Professor Hill, and begin with the notion of how is it that we're training people, how do the ethics fit into all of this, and why is it that those of us who are concerned, equally as concerned with the quality of care and the quality of moral judgment, why is it that our views of a reasonable balance are, a priori not reasonable? And I want you to keep in mind this vignette of the law school dean who says, I just never hire one, okay? Because that has been the experience of many pro-life candidates as they've gone through law school and through social work school and through medical school. There are just a bunch of there's barriers there that are so pervasive, that people really don't have a chance to deal with them because nobody ever publishes them on the wall, which is one of the reasons why the Bush era reg had a notice requirement in it, because it's not so much in one respect that people know that there's a problem, it's the underlying assumption that being pro-life or is unethical or anti women, and that being pro-choice is a bona fide occupational qualification for a lawyer, a physician, or a nurse or a social worker under Title VII. So I start from all of this as a Title VII lawyer and said, look, is it a willingness to provide services that would violate rights of conscience, including your rights not to associate? Is that a bona fide occupational qualification or not? You know, these are the kinds of questions that are implicit in the rules of professional conduct. One of our one of the members of the audience today, you know, asked the question, pointed out to me Rule 3.04 of the Model Rules of Judicial Conduct, which talk about how you must conduct yourself as a judge in a non-discriminatory manner. And you're not allowed to let any of these things fit into your, you know, you're not supposed to let it fit into any of the way in which you're a judge. We've seen cases in which judges are challenged because of their pro-life credentials. This wasn't an issue in the case that Professor Rienzi litigated as such, the BFOQ question, because the Moore Fitz case versus Blagojevich was about owners of pharmacies and whether or not they could be compelled to provide these services. But it certainly comes up, as Professor Hill pointed out, in standard pharmacies like CVS, Rite Aid, and Walmart. Especially now, as Walmart gets into the practice of what they call doc in a box. Okay, so you have to look at these questions, at least the Title VII questions, from the representation side, which is how you screen out the dissenters in the first place and keep them out of the profession, which has always been the reason behind the statutes and the rules in the first place, and then accommodation, requiring employers to make reasonable accommodations to people who have these objections. You know, but underlying all of this professional ethics debate that I think that both Dr. Block and Dr. Curlin, you know, talked about superbly. And I can't really add all that much to it other than to say that what we really need to do is ask that duty question, which is, you know, to what extent is a doctor or any other professional, a lawyer, a social worker, whatever, you know, required to provide services that they don't think, you know, are consistent either with their moral judgment, you know, or in the best interest of the patient. We talked about that, you know, Dr. Curlin and Dr. Block talked about that in terms of the PTSD diagnosis. Rule 2.1 of the Model Code of Professional Responsibility requires that the lawyer be able to counsel a client with respect to the moral aspects of what they're doing, if that would be relevant to the client. Okay, well, you know, if I would suspect that if anybody really tried to do it, they'd be hauled up before a bar review committee. And so when you look at this question, how did these things come up? What Dr. Block called the kerfluffle, I see it as being far more significant than that. You know, when you get ACOG and ABOG and the ABA making ethical pronouncements about this is the way it's going to be, that to me sounds an awful lot like saying, we don't care what your views are, this is the way it's going to be. You know, and this is, we have arrived at a moral position, you know, and you're going to either salute the flag or you're going to get out of the profession. Now that is, certainly would be a religious test for public office if it was imposed under the Constitution. You know, and it certainly looks an awful lot like an establishment of religion to me. You know, when you get these questions about how do you work this thing out, we have to have this ability to conduct a moral conversation. So that's why when I think that, you know, when Professor Hill says, oh, there's no free exercise right, you know, excuse me, I don't think that's right. You know, unless the courts are willing to close their eyes to the actual legislative history and where this stuff is coming from. You know, and I think that the judge in Illinois had it exactly right when he says these regs were put together to get pro-lifers. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And so this idea of the question, is it really a neutral law of general applicability, really depends on what the facts are. You know, and I'm not sure, given the discussion that we're having today, that you're going to see, you know, that there are many of those around. And one of the things that I'll just close with this, that one of the things that I always used to say when I spent time on the Civil Rights Commission talking about religious discrimination, which is very hard to get people to talk about, I said, sure, you can be black, you can be Polish, you can be Irish, you can be Catholic, you can be Jewish, but just don't act that way in public. Thank you.
Thanks, Professor Destro. What I'd like to do now with the remaining time is ask a couple of questions and give some of the panelists a chance to respond to one another. First, let me start with Dr. Curlin. Professor Hill made the point about the breadth of the Bush-era regulations and conceivably authorizing health care providers to do things like refuse to provide services to HIV-positive patients, or a pharmacy to say, I refuse to give out either drugs to treat HIV or things of that nature. What do you view as the stopping point, or do you view there to be a stopping point? Because it sounds like there's some general agreement that forcing physicians to perform an abortion against their will, it sounds like there's pretty general agreement that's something we shouldn't do. But the question is there a stopping point in your mind, or is the stopping point really determined by each and every healthcare provider?
Yes, there's a stopping point. I mean, you couldn't have a public profession if you didn't have some core set of practices and commitments that to which everyone is bound. I mean, it'd be like someone saying, I think we can all see it would be absurd if someone says, I'm a pacifist and I want to be an Army Ranger. You would say, well, that can't fit. And what doctors must be committed to is preserving and restoring the health of their patients. And where there's real clarity, and I can't draw the precise lines, but where there's clarity within the profession about the objectivity of this being an issue related to health, and that the practice is clearly one that's needed to restore and preserve that health, and that there's a sense of urgency and so on, then doctors can't opt out of that. And there's also within the profession, it's actually ancient. It goes back to Hippocrates, actually, which was not, you know, not Hippocratic Oath was not a myth. It was an oath by a very specific concrete reform movement within ancient Greece responding to what they saw as the corruption of the profession. And in that oath is the commitment that I will only go into the home of my patients with for the good of the sick, you know, to restore their health. So the line is where there's clarity that this is needed to restore and preserve patients' health, it must be done. And I was going to say the key is that people in the profession don't discriminate based on characteristics of patients that are not related to their health. So it's absolutely impermissible for a person to say, I'm not going to take care of your HIV because you're gay. I'm not going to take care of you because you're black. I'm not going to treat your infected gallbladder because you're a woman. That would be impermissible because those characteristics of patients are irrelevant to the practice that's being considered.
Okay. Professor Hill, I'd like to ask you if you'd like to respond on the First Amendment points that Professor Destro raised in response.
Yeah, sure. And I know there has been some litigation precisely around this issue. And I agree that a law that was specifically aimed with you know animus, with intent to get or to harm or to punish a specific members of a specific religion would be unconstitutional under the First Amendment. That's true. And if it were motivated by such an animus, an anti-religious, wouldn't have to be a particular, but an anti-religious animus, it would be unconstitutional, notwithstanding its you know facial neutrality. That being said, I think that first of all, we might disagree on the facts as to whether those laws are actually motivated by animus against pro-lifers as opposed to the view that women have a right to have access to contraception, for example, but that's a part of healthcare. But I think also, I would also question whether we can actually say pro-life equals religion. So even if those laws were aimed at pro-lifers, which, you know, I'm not sure they are, I don't think that a pro-life attitude is necessarily equivalent to a religious attitude. People are pro-life or pro-choice for reasons that don't pertain to religion. And you know, I mean, if you look at pro-life motivated legislation, I don't think we would say that all of that legislation that's motivated by a pro-life viewpoint is an Establishment Clause violation because it's motivated by pro-life viewpoints. Courts generally recognize that perspective lines up with certain religious beliefs but is not synonymous with a religious belief. So,
I think that's an excellent point that Professor Hill raises, and in some sense it gets to the idea of why conscientious objectors can't necessarily rely simply on one is that the Free Exercise Clause is not all that protective these days, but two is, of course, the fact that medical practitioners can have any religion and can have no religion at all, yet still have conscientious objections. So that is one reason why I think people do look to statutes for protection. Dr. Block, I want to ask you about something that one of the other panelists mentioned, which is the possibility that restrictions on conscience can act as a limiter on how many people and who will enter the profession. From your point of view as someone who analyzes healthcare policy, do you view that as at all a problem, or is there a point at which you see that to become a problem? If, for example, there are rules in place that say you always must be willing to refer for an abortion, and there's X percentage of the population who says, well, as a matter of my religion, I simply can't give someone the Planned Parenthood card and say, that's where it is, go get it. Do you have any concern about it restricting the number of people or which people enter the healthcare profession, or is it your view that that's kind of a red herring?
Well, I think there's a school of red herrings here swimming in parallel. I mean, plainly, as a practical matter, and here I agree with Jesse. I actually suspect that everybody on this panel would roughly agree with the following proposition, that in the majority of these situations, we can work out ways for a physician who has very strong feelings about a practice that is deemed by many to be legal and ethical and is within the parameters of medicine today, someone who has very strong feelings about that practice, we can, in the majority of circumstances, work it out for that person not to participate in that practice. And we can do that without substantially limiting a patient's access to the practice. There are these, marginal hard cases. The rural area, there's one doc within, 100 miles, and somebody wants or needs emergency contraception. And those, get harder. In terms of the numbers, I think we can, that's why I do think of this as more of a kerfuffle than a ferocious controversy. Do I think that so long as we work things out in that sort of way, there's not going to be a constraint on people coming into the profession? Yeah. Medical schools are not wanting for too few applicants today. Perhaps if this country channeled more, dare I say this in a law school, in my law school, perhaps if this country channeled more really smart people from medical and law schools into developing, products that we can sell in the global process of global competition, we would be doing better for ourselves. But I think that there's not an access problem based on insufficient numbers of folks applying to medical schools. And the kind of accommodation that we probably all agree to would make such compromises minimal.
Great. Great, except for the part about people not going to law school. That's no good at all. Professor Destra, let me ask you to deal with the example Professor Block brought up as something that might raise disagreement, which is the rural area with only one practitioner in town. What's your view as to whether in a situation like that, for example, only one OBGYN in town, whether at that point the conscientious objection must yield?
Well, I mean, a lot of it depends on factors that, like the availability. All the big medical care centers have life flights. Even the one that tried to fly into Reno Tahoe the other night while the controller was sleeping. I mean, basically the question is, how far are you really away, and how much of an emergency actually is it? Is a question of fact that I think in most cases simply is not an issue. Because if a pharmacy, for example, doesn't have emergency contraceptive in stock because they're not called upon that much, they're going to have to call the supply company and FedEx, and the question, does this person have to write the prescription? You can have a bunch of different people write prescriptions. One of the ethical issues that has always mystified me, and I know this from looking at professional ethics issues and practicing in the field, is if I refer to another lawyer, what's my obligation to check out how good he or she is? Because if they're a loser, and I send the client over there, am I responsible for not undertaking a due, investigatory kind of question? It seems to me that Dr. Block is exactly right when he says, if we work these out as professionals, then we'll be fine. But if you try and get, you say, well, look, this is the ideal thing, and we have to worry, this is the only way you can do it, and we're going to fence you out, like the dean of that law school said, then we got a problem, and that is exactly the reason why those statutes are there, and that's the reason the rule was written the way it was written.
Can I just make a brief comment, Mark? I can just say from our own data, interestingly, the data that I and colleagues have collected, some of which is published and some of which is not yet, that the people in the rural areas, most doctors don't want to work in the rural areas. And most people who tend to be willing to work in the rural areas tend to be more conservative. Mm-hmm. And they tend to be more likely to object, and we know this, you know, they're significantly more likely to object to abortion and emergency contraception and so on. So it really is an issue. If you say that these folks have to participate in these things, then you do put pressure on them to leave rural areas and go to the urban areas. And we already know that there are enormous issues of access in the rural areas. So the question is whether, on the whole, you want to live with having a pro-life OBGYN who won't give you, you know, emergency contraception, and you have to drive to the next state to get your emergency contraception, or whether you'd rather not have an OBGYN.
Professor Hill?
Yeah, I also just wanted to jump in to say that I kind of agree with the overall point, again, that this, I'm mostly fine with the idea that these things get worked out on an ad hoc basis in a way that's more or less satisfactory to both parties. I think, you know, the issue here, of course, is that once you have the law getting involved, you have lawyers making a hash of the whole thing, right? And now you have terms that are crystallized into regs and statutes, and there's something to fight about now. And so, you know, that's part of what my concern is, exactly what the terms of those regulations are. But I also think that, you know, there is an expressive function on the other side that these laws are performing, which is to stigmatize the procedures and to make it okay to stigmatize them and to reinforce the idea that not only can providers refuse, but, you know, maybe they should. And I think that that's definitely part of the message here. I think telling schools that they don't have to train in medical schools, that they don't have to provide abortion training is fine, but to the extent that you know, it's going to result in a world where there are fewer and fewer people who know how to perform that emergency abortion that just might someday come into the ER and nobody knows what to do. I think that there are longer term and sort of more expressive consequences to these sorts of regulations that we should be concerned about too.
Dr. Block, and then maybe we'll get a few questions from the audience after Dr. Block.
Yeah, I think this is almost all about the expressive function on both sides. The access point is, a very large red herring, since there's a, dare I say this, a non-random relationship between those who make this particular access argument about, say, rural areas and objection to a historic reform in this country that is extending access to care to 30 million Americans who haven't been able to afford it. And that's the Affordable Care Act, the health reform law. So when I see people who make the access argument in this context also be at the vanguard in supporting expansion of access to health care and supporting universal coverage, then I will be impressed with the genuineness of the access argument.
Questions from the audience? Yes, ma'am. Anybody want to take a shot?
I don't know the status of the case.
Professor Destro?
I know.
I mean, these kinds of cases come up, they only make it into the newspapers periodically, but they're there. And the courts are almost uniformly hostile to the claims that people don't want to participate in this thing. And that's why I raised the point in my talk about, you know, getting the ACOG and ABOG involved. You know, because judges read the newspapers, you know, people can come in and make the claim that, you know, an ethical nurse has to do this. And so, you know, and having been a litigator, you know, and having heard judges come out on the bench and say, well, you have a right to believe anything you want to believe, but not to do anything you want to do, you just turn to your client and say, you just lost. Mm-hmm. You know, so, I mean, I think there's a hostility out there for the reasons I pointed out. It's built into the training.
I don't know the facts of the case more than basically what you've just said, so I can't, you know, comment specifically. But, I would say, first of all, that sounds like it could be a violation also just of Title VII, if that's actually what happened. I don't know. Often there's more to these cases than meets the eye. But without even touching on the regs themselves. I just want to add that, you know, I've read ACOG's position on this exact issue, and it's pretty close to my position, which is not that anybody should be forced to perform procedures, but that, as long as access can be protected and the patient isn't harmed, that refusals are fine. So,
okay. Sir?
What I argue in the book is that these kinds of moral judgments pervade medicine. Now, you're absolutely right; they're more prominent in psychiatry. And another example I go into in the book is the idea of narcissism. The idea of narcissism as a character disorder. It would seem sometimes in Washington that narcissism, effectively executed, is an especially useful trait. In fact, there's talk about the next issue of the DSM. Voting out narcissism as a disorder. What that says about where our society is going is an interesting question. Absolutely a huge moral dimension. I bring up the case of Lipitor. I was thinking, do I have a right to, as a doctor, if I think that, people who are 40-something, and I know I'm not supposed to say fat, that's politically incorrect.
You are being recorded.
Oh, my. if I think that somebody ought to be at the gym, can I decide not to prescribe Lipitor? I think that would be viewed as out of range. Having said that, medicine in saying that Lipitor is appropriate or some other statin is appropriate, I'm not shilling for Pfizer here, medicine in saying that a statin is appropriate, if your LDLs are above, whatever, is making a judgment that is in part a moral judgment. What I argue in the book is that we should have more open conversation about that kind of moral judgment. And I think that the battle in the early 70s over whether being gay or lesbian is a mental illness is just a kind of high watermark for the visibility of this moral judgment driving clinical practice. Does it undermine either psychiatry or all of medicine in terms of legitimacy? No. What it underscores is that moral judgment is pervasive in this realm.
Yeah.
I think these work. I want to ask a couple of panelists. I think the first three have raised the issue of there being a balance between physician conscience and patient autonomy. It seems to me patient autonomy is always presented as only counseling in the direction of, for example, restricting physician conscience. But it seems to me that there are also women who want to be able to access a doctor who comprehensively considers the unborn child a person. And therefore, if all doctors have to refer for abortion, all those women's autonomy to choose a doctor who shares their values will be taken completely off the table. So isn't the autonomy of patients in this debate also a red herring, perhaps, because it's only viewed in a one-sided manner?
Dr. Block or Dr. Curlin? Or?
I would say that, to live in a pluralistic culture, you have to live with people who won't go along with your way of doing things. that won't participate in the goals that you have. And I think the example you gave is a good one, in that there are clearly sectors of society who want people to provide services that those people are not willing to provide. At the same time, there are sectors of society who want a person, it's quite clear in OBGYN and from our own research, who want a physician who shares with them some certain basic commitments about the fetus and about the goals of OBGYN care and so on. And it is the case, I can tell you from interviews with a lot of people and from studying trends in the makeup of obstetrics and gynecology, that the obstetrics and gynecology field has been steadily over the past 30 years becoming less welcome to people who are not committed to the full range of reproductive health care services being made available to women according to women's best judgment about how they should be used. And I mean, it's a very clear trend. So there will be fewer OBGYNs in the future who in those communities that share those convictions with that sector of the population.
Dr. Block?
There is a logical slip and fall here, and that is this slippage between talking about having a doctor that shares your values, or at least, maybe more importantly than absolutely sharing them, empathizes with your values. So the law school dean who said such a thing, you know, the plural of anecdote is not equal data, and so therefore I don't accept the proposition that anecdote indicates an overall, you know, attitude that's that prohibitive. But the law school dean that says that would make a lousy doctor, counselor sort of person, because that law school dean is demonstrating a lack of capability to engage in this sort of empathy. But there's a big gap between saying that there ought to be that kind of sharing of values or empathy with values versus saying that the very act of participating in a pragmatic accommodation to enable the service to be available, even if you yourself believe it's personally wrong, that the very act of accommodating that way is somehow an expression of not sharing the values. It is there's an asymmetry here between, you know, being Catholic in a little C sense, being inclusive, versus being exclusive and saying no to somebody, of imposing your values upon others.
I'm just saying that it's a fact that there's a sector of the population who would see a physician being willing to facilitate a person getting an abortion actively as being an expression of a set of values that they do not embrace, and they would not want a physician like that to care for them when they're pregnant. And it is,
and
it's a fact.
To be able, that
it's a fact
be able
that
to choose amongst physicians. And I, as you point out, as we all pointed out, all this gets harder in, you know, rural areas. And on the other hand, there are, you know, policy tools that we have for dealing with access. Physicians do follow incentives. None of this is going to take away the problem in rural areas, but the problem in rural areas for medical care access more generally, especially primary care access, is in large measure a problem of incentives that health policy tools can address.
Okay. One last question, sir. You had it for a while.
There we go. I have a bit of a different take, I think, than all four of you up there. And rather than trying to address all of the points of view, I'm going to focus on one particular area that I thought Professor Destro was going to go to, and maybe he didn't quite get there, at least not as I understood it. The fundamental question that I don't think was really addressed here is, what is the freedom of conscience? What does that mean fundamentally? And I think once that is established, a lot of what I heard would either disappear or would fall into place as sort of the litmus test here. As I understand the documents, the legal instruments that describe this thing, probably the most fundamental would be UDHR, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Article 18 probably would fit in there. Even if the reason for conscientious objection wasn't based on religion, because it also covers the right not to believe. And it seems to me that if we truly believe what is enshrined in that document, there has to be accommodation for conscientious objectors, even where we don't like it. So the Nazis get to march in Skokie, Illinois. The Westboro Baptist Church gets to protest at military funerals. We don't like these things. They're deeply offensive. But when you live in a society that's supposed to be pluralistic and democratic, you accommodate these people, even if you don't like it. So, yeah, we have an example of the rural physician who doesn't want to do abortions. You know what? Tough. If he doesn't want to do abortions, he doesn't have to. And if you don't want to live in that town, you don't have to live in that town, and he gets to continue to practice. If we live in a society where we're going to force people to do certain things that are against their conscience, it seems to me that we're violating the very concept that is more fundamental than everything else we've talked about today.
All right, I think we're going to end on that note because, in theory, we have to end 4 minutes ago. But hopefully I can at least stick around a little bit, and if our panelists can stick around a few more minutes. I know there's some people who had their hands up the whole time and we just couldn't get to. Technically, we're done, but I'm at least going to stick around if people want to keep kicking it around.